following is an unrehearsed taped interview with Bruce Fraley, a farmer in Rockcastle County, Kentucky. The interview was conducted by Jenny Scott for the Kentucky Oral History Commission. The interview was conducted at Mr. Fraley's place of business in Berea, Kentucky, on August 4th, 1983, at 1 o'clock p.m. First, Mr. Fraley, I'd like to thank you for taking time to talk to me today. I'd like to start out, you tell me your personal background, when and where you were born, your parents' names, grandparents' names, anything you can think of.
Well, I came from Floyd County, which is between Hyman and Prestonsburg, and Hyman being the bordering county, Knott County. That's 3 miles from the Knott County line. I was raised in a rural mining town. My family has been in Kentucky since the early 1700s, and we were a native of that area when the coal camp came in. And Elkhorn Coal Corporation, and the name of the town's Whalen. Whalen operated. The camp was built in 1914, and we lived about a quarter of a mile out of town. And my grandfather's farm was the, in fact, the whole camp came off of the Martin family, which my mother was a Martin. And where the post office is there was his home, and he owned, the Martin family owned 9 miles of that Beaver Creek Valley. They owned from the mouth of Salt Lick Creek, which is Bosco, to the mouth of Caney Creek, which is over in Knott County. And my family got the Martin family got a government grant from the governor of Virginia in Kentucky County. And we still own 168 acres of that.
Of that property?
Of that property.
And when were you born?
I was born November the 9th, 1930. The fourth son, the second son of Ray Fraley and Eunice Martin Fraley.
Okay, let's go back to this coal camp, because I'm doing a project on all the coal camps in Kentucky. Let's talk a little bit about that. Who owned this camp?
The Elkhorn Coal Corporation owned the camp, and it was headquartered out of Charleston, West Virginia. And the C&O Railroad, Chesapeake and Ohio Railroad, serviced that area. And Whalen was the end of the line. They had a turntable there. When the train came in, they had to turn them around on a round circle, and every little boy in town always gave them all the help they wanted. When it took four people to turn the engine. They had a track that they put the cars off on one track, and then they shifted and come up another track, and then they turned around, and they were, this was the end of the line at the head of the creek, and then they were ready to go back down the creek to Martin. The train stayed at Martin. It came from Martin. It was 14 miles away.
Did you live in, you didn't live in the camp, now, did you?
I did both. Oh. I was born and reared an eighth of a mile out of town. And there were 7 children. And when I was 4 years old, 1934, my daddy bought a garage. He bought the stock in a garage, and the garage belonged to Glowgory Coal Corporation. He rented the building, the metal building, from them. And the two previous owners of this garage had gone broke, and they were selling Lafayette cars. And Daddy got the Chevrolet dealership. And Mother opened a little restaurant. And some of the things I remember about Whalen was, Whalen got to be by far the largest town in the county. I think Prestonsburg had 800 people, which was the county seat. Whalen had 4,000 at one time. They had 1,000 coal loaders there. And they closed the mine in 1952, and they were 27, it was 27 miles from the tipple to the face of the coal. And my childhood years was middle years till I was probably, I was born outside of town, and then we moved into town, which in this metal building, and we had mother had an apartment up over a restaurant.
Mm-hmm. But you own and, that?
No, we owned the business, but we didn't own either building. Nobody owned anything in the camps except the companies, you know.
Okay, so you did live in a company.
So we, but Daddy was in, Daddy was in business, but he was, what he could do and couldn't do was dictated by the coal camp. And
Well, wasn't that unusual to have a private business in a company town?
Well,
like
it's probably unusual in this respect that there was two coal camps are side by side. One was called Glow, which was owned by the Glow Glory Coal Corporation, and I'm not sure where they were headquarters at. And it was a smaller mines, but it was a good sized mine by today's standards. And then they had a piece of land. They had like 3 acres that crossed the creek over on the Wayland side. Now all you had to do to get from Glow to Wayland was cross right Beaver Creek, which
you
was
were
a,
in another town.
You were in another town, but they all everybody called that Wayland, called the whole area Wayland, but. And they had this 2 acres, and they had the garage over there. And my daddy was a good friend to John Hampton, who was superintendent of Glow Glory. They had worked together, grew up as boys in Glow.
Yeah, I heard that.
And he liked Daddy, and I guess he gave Daddy an opportunity to rent this building, which they were not using. They, you know, they had the building that was isolated from their town, from the creek. Mm-hmm. So Daddy opened this small garage there and had a service station with it. And that would have been from 19. Daddy had. Daddy spent 39 years as a Chevrolet dealer. He started in 34. If you want to work out the years, and I can tell you one thing of interest to me as a child. And money was scarce, mainly because we had. Daddy had a big family, and you just didn't sell a lot of cars or anything else, you know, in a. In the 30s and the 40s anywhere.
Yeah.
And to get my spending money, this boy had a homemade shoebox. It was made out of a Hercules powder keg. And the top of the shoebox looked just like the sole of your foot on it was in reverse. And a fellow by the name of Clarence something had it. He was about 16 year old. And he wanted to sell his shoebox. And he had, I remember he had two boxes of polish in it. One of them was Dynashine, which was a black polish, and the other one was an oxblood, but I think it was Griffin shoe polish. Had a little jar of soap suds in it, and had two rags that you shine shoes with, and two scrub brushes. He wanted 50 cents for that box, so I asked Daddy if he'd buy it for me. He said, "Well, you want shine shoes?" I said, "Yeah, I will." He said, "Well, I'll buy it if you pay me back." So I bought this shoebox with Daddy's help from this fellow by the name of Clarence. I cannot remember his last name. And Clarence had got big enough that he was ashamed to shine shoes. So he got out of the shoe shining business. He'd been doing it maybe for 10 years. So what you had in these coal camps, you had what you call scrip. Now, scrip is a duplication of money. The Elkhorn scrip had an E stamped in it. And I remember that a penny was. A penny in Elkhorn scrip would work any 10-cent coin machine. Any of them,
didn't
anywhere.
Take little boys long you to find that out.
You didn't have to do anything except to put it in there, and it would operate a dime machine. And I remember some of the things that you could get for a dime was to play the jukebox for, you know, and get a nickel a play. You get two plays on the jukebox. Mm-hmm. And then there was, there might not have supposed to have been, but there were slot machines in Wayland.
I think they had them.
And I don't know if it were legal or illegal. I'm pretty sure that it probably wasn't legal. But anyway, I took this shoe shine box, and I would earn 80 cents with this in money. Whenever I got 80 cents in money, I quit shining shoes. Now, you can only shine shoes for about 4 days. That's four payday and 3 days after payday. Then everybody was broke again. And I got my regular customers, and I would earn 80 cents in cash now, in silver money, government money. And then there was a swinging bridge over across Glow. And I go across that swinging bridge to a fellow's store by the name of Tandy Martin. I go to Tandy Martin's store. And Tandy was he owned the little piece of land that cornered in on the two towns of Wayland and Glow. And he had this store, and it was his own property and his own building. And you could buy more groceries at Tandy Martin's store for 80 cents than you could buy at the Elkhorn store for a dollar.
That's so, a store.
they had a monopoly on the money. That's the reason they gave it out. If you worked one day, I'm kind of tying a lot of things in here together. I'll tie it all back, try to straighten it out here.
Let me ask you something just a minute. Okay.
So back to what I was saying there on the earning the 80 cents. Tandy Martin would take scrip, and if you took scrip, that was this artificial money that the company put out. You'd go to Tandy Martin's store and give him a dollar in scrip, and he would give you 80 cents in groceries. But you got more groceries for 80 cents there at Tandy's store than you did at Elkhorn Company store for a dollar. So what, and the companies would not redeem money legally.
You mean you couldn't?
In other words, Tandy Martin got this scrip, and he had to find a way to get rid of it. So what I would do, there's where my 80 cents in money would come. I'd go over there, and I would buy a dollar's worth of scrip from Tandy Martin. For 80 cents. Then I run right back across the swinging bridge, and I go to the little restaurant there we call the Fountain. And when I'd stand outside the door, and every time somebody would go inside the door, they wouldn't let you inside. Every time somebody would go in, I'd say, "Can I cash your scrip?" Well, what I was telling him was, "Look, if you're going to spend 15 cents in there, let me give you 15 cents in scrip, and you give me 15 cents in money. And you can't buy any more with money or with scrip, but the money will do me more good. You'll be helping me, see." So he would give me his 15 cents, or 20 or 19 or whatever he was going to spend in there. He would give me the money. If he had money, he would give me the money. And then I would give him the scrip, and then he'd go in and make his purchase. Well, when I cashed that dollar worth of scrip, I'd made a 20% profit. So I've made as much as $3 and $4.
On your 80 cents.
On my 80 cents a day, but that would be from early morning, you know, standing on concrete, till late that night. I guess I've made as much as $6 cash and scrip, just running back. Every time I'd get another 80 cents, I'd run back to Tandy Martin's grocery and buy a dollar worth of scrip till I would cash all that scrip out, and I had a pocket full of money, because you could take, well, money was really worth a quarter. You couldn't carry the candy you could buy for a quarter. But I spent most of mine on ice cream, I remember very well, and sodas, yeah, at the Fountain, which Mother had this restaurant, and she didn't have a soda fountain, and I spent most of my money. Now, if you want to cut that tape off, I'll quit right there, and we'll get back on the farm.
We'll get back to farm, and then I'll come back, and I do want to hear more about the coal camp, because I love those.
Now, back to my...
back to your grandparents.
To my grandparents.
Where did they come from?
My grandmother was Sarah Webb, my mother's mother. And my grandfather was E.S. Martin. Everybody called him Uncle Elbert. He had a store outside of town, too.
His own store.
Yeah, but it wasn't as big a store, and he didn't get as much scrip as Tandy did. And it was,
what was Tandy related to you?
Tandy Martin. See, the Martins owned that whole country. Tandy Martin was the first cousin to my granddaddy. E.S. Martin.
Related.
Yeah, they're all related. And he was in that valley from the early 1700s, because the Martin family, which goes back to old Johnny Martin. Old Johnny Martin started all the Martins in Knott and Floyd County, and there's a book in Hyman that belongs to the Martin family. It's probably 6 inches thick. With every Martin, it'd make a Bible look small. And even though my family, my children are recorded in this book as being Martins, even though they're Fraley, they're recorded in the family's tree section in that book as being Martins. And Martins are very prominent people. Now, what happened back in those days, the Webbs down at Allen, Kentucky, where my grandmother came from, they had small, rich farms with, you know, what we call big bottoms that grew good corn and vegetables. They had money and very little land, and the Martins had a lot of land and very little money, and it was about 20 miles from Wayland to Allen. That's where the Webbs came from. There was a whole lot of Martins. Men would go to Allen to get a Webb wife.
Get that money.
And they would get the money, and then the Webbs were looking for the Martins because they wanted that land that was up on Beaver Creek, which they had hundreds and hundreds of acres. they were not poor people, but they, the
land poor.
They were land poor, and the Webbs were just they had very little land and had money, you know. So that's where my family started. You'll turn that off for these people. We'll go.
Okay, we're talking about your grandparents.
All right, then I described the Martins and the Webbs. My daddy's family were of Prussian descent, and they came to this country in 1806 with passage from the Netherlands to New Amsterdam, which is New York, from New Amsterdam or New York down to North Carolina, and from North Carolina up into Arnton, Ohio, and from Arnton, Ohio into Johnson County, which is Paintsville is the county seat, and into Floyd County. So
why?
They.
What brought them there?
Well, the mines paid good. You know, it was dangerous work, and you know, just to have a job that paid anything was good in those days.
From they what came my, from, to the
so
mines.
So they came to the mines and took the risk to get the money. It would beat any type of farm labor that you get. Mines always paid more than farm, and in those days, it would be, you know, it would be either industrial or it would be farming. And they preferred the little higher wage that they got farming, I mean, that they got mining over farming. And the way that that my granddaddy got into Floyd County, my great-granddaddy was a Union soldier, and he was discharged at Elkhorn City, which is on the Virginia-Tennessee line. It's a breaks of the Big Sandys there. He was discharged at Elkhorn City. And then Johns Creek goes all the way to the Ohio River, and he was following Johns Creek back, and he was mustered out there and given a small amount of money. And he was walking down Johns Creek, which Johns Creek is 99 miles long. It comes from Pike County, comes through Pike, which Elkhorn City is in Pike County. And he would work one day and walk 3 days. He would work for somebody and get some food and chop wood or plow or whatever they had to do, you know. And then he'd get 3 days worth of food, and then he'd walk 3 days. So after he stopped on one farm that was owned by the Begleys on Johns Creek. I said Bagley, it's really Bagley. Mm-hmm. He was of Swedish descent. And this Mr. Bagley had a, which was one of my descendants, he had a daughter, and my great-granddaddy was attracted to her, and he stayed that winter and worked for this Mr. Bagley. And he was a timberman, a Swede. Mm. And he had come from Sweden. He wasn't a native of the United States. So when spring come, I guess they had gotten to be fond of each other, and he had a 40-acre farm in Arnton, Ohio. So he walked then that spring to Arnton, Ohio, and he sold his 40-acre farm, and he came back to Johns Creek and married my great-grandmother.
Oh, so that's how they got in.
And then my granddaddy was born to these two people, which his name was James Thomas Fraley. The Civil War Fraley was Sam Fraley. And when after he'd moved back to Johns Creek, he went to Ashland, and he managed to get a hold of a tugboat type thing, just something a little bit better than a raft, and they would pull with mule or horse, they would pull this, I guess, boat. We'll call it a boat. It was like a floating grocery store. He had the things in the mountains before highway. He had things in the mountains that the mountain people didn't have, like buttons and brass and probably store-bought clothes, maybe pistols or, you know, some type
anything
of hardwire,
that
anything that they couldn't get up in the mountains. And there was no road, so they traveled the Big Sandy River. And the Big Sandy River empties in to the Ohio at Catlettsburg, mm-hmm. which is next to Ashland. And they would pull this boat up the river, and he would in turn, instead of trading this for money, he would trade it for merchandise.
And what kind of merchandise?
Well, ducks, tobacco, anything that, that wouldn't perish till he got back out there with it. Maybe even livestock and dam, goose dam, whatever.
Anything,
you know, anything.
They had on their hands,
yeah,
to trade.
But he would trade. There was very little money exchanged. And then when my granddaddy got on that to do that, he and my great granddaddy died. Then this business was, the river ceased being the way of travel. And they put roads in, so he did it for a few years, and it got so he couldn't make a good living at it, so he quit it. And then he married, and he had 14 children in his family, 9 boys.
Oh,
and my daddy was, out of those nine boys, my daddy would have been the fifth son.
And he still lived on this farm?
Well, no, he ended up at Oxford, Kentucky, which is another old mining town. My grandfather ended up at Oxford, Kentucky, which was a mining town. And he came to Wayland, and when he came to Wayland, they offered him a job because he had 3 sons already married and old enough, ready to marry. And old. They wanted to put as many boys, as many men, in one of these houses as they could get. Because the housing was scarce, they had to furnish your housing. They charged you something like, when I was growing up, it was like $32 a month for rent. And I don't know what it would have been then, but anyway, if you had a large family with a bunch of boys, you go to a mining camp. They wanted you because they were getting 5 people that would work in the mines.
And it would fill up those
that
places.
Would, yeah, and wouldn't be taking up but one house, so you'd only be taking that one house instead of 5. And so my granddaddy, he got a job at Wayland as a foreman, and he took my I probably ought to get off this mines now. You know, we were talking about farming.
It's hard.
But I get wrapped up in this stuff myself when I get talking about it. But anyway, my granddaddy had this little 185 acres at the edge of Wayland, and they bought his coal reserves for like $380. And the first mine they mined out at Wayland was the mine behind, was the hill behind my house where I was raised. And he sold his gas rights for $500. And there's still 2 gas wells on the farm.
Oh,
sold
no.
It to Kentucky, West Virginia gas company. And he had this little farm. He was a merchant, had a store, and had this little farm. Out of this 185 acres, there was about 13 acres that you could raise crops on.
Rest of his hill.
And we had, rest of his hill. We had 3 mules and 3 cows. We had 1 cow always fresh with milk. And then sometimes we had 2, but always 1, and never 3. We had the cows would calve at different times to keep us milk.
Fresh milk.
And I had this farming background in this mining town. So
kind of the best of 2 worlds.
So there. What happened was that we would raise corn on these bottoms. And we did it all by hoe. I know we had a bottom plow, and we always had 1 team of mule and 1 single mule that we plowed by himself. And we would raise this corn, and we could raise enough corn to feed those cows and fatten 6 hogs off of this 13 acres.
And feed the mules,
too. And we killed our own hogs and raised almost everything we ate. So I got this background of farming from my grandparents, and we lived in their house on this farm. And when I was 6 years old, I milked a cow twice a day. I gave 1 milking to my granddaddy, which was a morning milk, and my family, well, my granddaddy and my aunt got 1 milking, which was Nell Shepherd, and she had 3 children. She and my granddaddy took 1 milking. Then my family, being larger, we got the evening milk. But I always milked a cow. And I milked a cow till I was 18 years old. And I sold, in the good part of the year, I would sell some milk downtown. And I got to keep that milk if there was any. Got to keep the money that milk would bring because I was
the one doing the milking.
Yeah, there was 13 grandchildren, but I was the one that did the milking.
Oh.
And so I got this background of growing
vegetables. That milk that you had left over, how much did you get for it? Do you remember?
it seems to me like that I delivered it. I had two customers in Glow and two customers in Wayland, and I'm thinking maybe 40 cents a gallon.
That was pretty good money.
You know, I'm thinking, but then I'd have to walk to them and take it to them, you know. And I didn't take, they didn't get milk every day. I took it in a gallon jar or a half gallon jar, whichever one they ordered. And it was all whole milk. It wasn't pasteurized.
Well, how'd you keep it?
Well, we had refrigeration at Wayland. You know, we had electric and had refrigeration.
Well, that another thing.
But what you did, you know, with a family of seven, you didn't have any trouble keeping it, you know.
Right.
You know, we made our own butter from it. We took and dipped off the cream, and we churned our own butter. And we had a first-class little operation on a little small farm at the edge of town, and my granddaddy had a store, and then my daddy had a garage. And we did quite well, and I guess we were considered to be prominent people in that area.
Okay. And I'm sure.
Then when
what
I left,
what did you grow to eat there in the gardens?
Well, we grew the staples that they grow today, and we canned enough beans for every day of the year, for every member of the family, for every how much you needed a jar for each day. We grew our own potatoes, and we hold them up in the ground, and we took and wrapped the apples that we had in orchard. We took and wrapped the apples in newspaper and stored them in my granddaddy's house in a cool place, and we had apples all winter. We turned cabbage upside down and bury that cabbage and leave the stalk out, and he'd keep all winter in the garden. We made a lot of tomatoes and tomato juice, and we had a homemade rock cellar that we kept this stuff in, and it would be full. And we would buy some peaches, and then we had those little non-freestone peaches that we made peaches out of and made preserves out of, and we had that in there. We had sugar beets in there, and we had pickle beets in there. And we had corn that was pickled corn, and we had pickled beans in big stone jugs, and we had chickens, and we had hogs.
So you could live without going to the grocery at all, couldn't you?
No, well, we didn't have any way to get sugar, and we didn't have any way to get coffee, except for the salt, except for the things we couldn't grow. I mean,
the salt,
you know,
and sugar.
You know, we didn't have
coffee.
A sewer bill, and in the beginning, when I was a small child, we didn't have electric bill. We didn't have any kind of a bill. So it really didn't take a lot of money, and took a lot of hard work and a lot of good management, and I had to work in this grandmother.
But you sure ate well, didn't you?
We ate well, and we had clean clothes, and we did better than everybody else around there.
Mm-hmm.
We really did. We did better than everybody. So when I came to school, one reason for coming to Eastern, which I came to Eastern and graduated from high school at Wayland in 1949, I think there was 38 that graduated in my class, which today's standard, that'd be real small.
But then that was a lot.
I was one of the first children out of Wayland that ever went to college. It went off and went to college and stayed, you know. But when I left home, I left home thinking about that I wanted to get away from the mud and the cow manure and the chaff tans that you get from milking in cows and shucking corn and
the whole bit.
And just getting away from, I wanted to get away from the yellow mud and the cold and the hardships of the country, and I came to Eastern to get away from. But I didn't think I ever wanted to see another cow or another farm or another piece of yellow mud or any more cow manure. But as soon as I got a hold of enough money that was just above a living with my wife Betty, which is Betty Fennell, I bought a farm with it, and I guess it was in my blood. And the first farm I bought over here, the deed calls for 56 acres in Rockcastle County, and it surveys out 76. There's 22 acres of level land on it, and a house and a barn. I bought that in probably 62. I'd have to go back and look, 1962. Mm-hmm. And on this farm, I grow cattle.
What kind of cattle?
Raise cattle. Well, I started out with Hereford cattle.
Let me turn it.
Okay.
We're talking about your farm in Rochester.
So I bought this little farm and...
Now, where's it located?
It's located on Clear Creek, 8.2 miles out Scaffcane Road from Berea, Kentucky. It's, there's a little town on that creek called Wilde and another little town called Dispatana.
And, I've never heard
and
of
it's between the two of them. The name Dispatana, the Berea Masonic Lodge was moved from Dispatana to Berea. And at Dispatana, at one time, was the largest settlement west of the Mississippi River. And they tanned fur and leather. They tanned hides there, and it was called, this area has always been good for black oak bark. And black oak bark was the most natural way to tan leather. They would put, they would dig pits and take put black oak bark, and these pits would fill with water. And they'd take a hide, you know, a squirrel or beef or what have you, tie a wire to it, and put a stake there and throw it in this pit. And they left it in there so long. I've never seen this done, but I've heard my daddy-in-law talk about it. And they stayed in there so long, and when they pulled the wire out, the hive was on the other end, and all the hair was off from it, and it was already treated. And the black oak bark did that. Well, when the railroads came through at Wilde, which is about 6 miles below the little farm that I own and below the farm that my father-in-law was raised on Clear Creek there, they started buying the black oak bark and shipping it east. So then cities like Louisville, Louisville would be west, but Louisville was a big tanning center. So was St. Louis, but most of your tanning of leather was up east and your New England. So we started shipping our black oak bark up there, and then they started, then the Dispatana area over there, it got to be, you know, that got to be a different way of life, and they no longer tan hides and leather over on Clear Creek. So the town started, little town started declining, and then there wasn't enough people for the lodge, so they moved the Masonic Lodge, from there to Berea. And then that became just a regular little farming community. The houses that they had built for this tan yard was gone. And when I first bought my farm, there was one piece of a log house left that was about 2 foot high. Oh. That was on the farm that belongs to Huey Miller. Now, Huey's dead now, but his son Jackie would own the farm now. And
it's funny how a town just disappears like that, isn't it?
Well, it's funny, but back to this type of change of life or change of the way of life, that tan yard business went out, and that little community died or disappeared, and the people on the in the Clear Creek area years ago would use Berea as a market to sell their vegetables. So they had the college up here. People would bring blackberries to Berea College, and they had their, in fact, Berea College would take their cannery. They had a small cannery. They'd take their cannery to Clear Creek and buy blackberries to make the preserves that they fed the students in the Clear Creek area. In fact, on the farm that my father-in-law owns now, W.A. Fennell. And then they would make the preserves and bring them back to Berea, and then they would serve them through the commons. They call the
cafeteria.
It wasn't a cafeteria. I guess you sit down at a table and they brought the food to you, didn't they, Betty? And it didn't take a lot to live because you didn't have an electric bill. Now this has been told to me by my father-in-law, W.A. Fennell, and his daddy, Ott Fennell, which Ott's been deceased about, I guess, almost 30 years. But he was an extremely well-educated man. And since I'm talking about Ott Fennell, Ott was educated in a private school at Kirksville.
In a private school?
Uh-huh. He come from a prominent family, and their farm at Kirksville is where the Kirksville school is now.
Oh.
And he moved to the mountain to get more land, you know, and his grandfather died, and he got a piece of that land, took that money, and bought a piece of land on the Brush Creek side of Clear Creek, which is across the hill, another little valley from mine, just across the hill, across Loman Hill. And then he, at one time, ended up working out by hands and grubbing and doing straight farm work. He worked out 2,000 acres that way.
Oh, my gosh.
And then when he got to be an older man, he moved to town to be close to a doctor and close to hospital facilities. And he sold all that land except about 350 acres, which is still in the Fennell family. My father-in-law, W.A. Fennell, owns the farm now. And then I have the farm that joins that farm. And I also have another farm that's kind of in the middle of that farm.
Mm.
So what they did, they could farm and make a living. Well, that's a different type of farming then than it is now. Now most of the people on Clear Creek and Rockcastle County, on these smaller, especially in the Clear Creek area, they have a job drywalling in Lexington or painting in Berea or working for Berea College or working for Dresser Industries or working for Parker Seal or Goodyear or one of our factories here. And then they use the farm as a place to live and as a supplemental income. The farms aren't big enough
to make a living.
To make a living on. So what they do, I think they get the best of two worlds. They get to live on these farms and work on it, and then they get to come to town to get their money and have to have a cash flow in their home. And the two things work out. They mesh real well, and they do extremely good. And
okay, we're back to talking about your farm, Rockcastle County.
So what got me into the farming business, my father-in-law already had. The reason I chose that area is because he already had this farm there. So I bought the farm that joined him, and then I bought two other farms, and I put three together, and I sold one. I know I bought this one farm below me, which was a bottomland farm with 30-some acres of land, which is not really a very big farm. There was 50-plus acres in the farm, but 30 acres tillable, about 32 to be exact, and a house and a barn. And I was selling about 5,000 pounds of tobacco a year off from it. But I bought this farm, and I paid $24,500 for this 50-some acres. And with a worn-out house on it and a worn-out barn and growed up in a swamp in the center of it to where it was a wet farm. And a creek get up, it would run through it. So I bought the farm, cleaned out the swamp, put 10,000 feet of tile in it, put a new fence all the way around it, remodeled a house, remodeled a barn on my own time, and mowed it off as pretty and manicured it as nice as you can. And my father-in-law told me, said, "Bruce, you'll never see this farm bring this much money again." And I didn't feel that way, or I wouldn't have bought it. And he wasn't telling me that to hurt my feelings. He was telling me that he thought I'd made a mistake by buying the farm and giving $24,500 for it. Mm-hmm. Well, I kept the farm 11 years, and I sold it for $69,000.
You made your money back.
I made my money back. So I sold the best part of my farm and the part that I spent most time on and manicuring and making pretty.
I sold it because
when I made it attractive for myself, I made it attractive for somebody else. Mm-hmm. And right now, Terry White, that has white concrete blocks and supplies down here, he owns the farm and lives on it. And I do not raise my tobacco.
You lease it out.
I have a man that raises it on the half. He sharecrops it. And a fellow by the name of Fred Cook that does an extremely good job. Fred works at Bluegrass Army Depot. He lives at Three Lakes, Kentucky.
At Three Lakes.
Which is about 3 miles from my little farm, which he lives on the Brush Creek side, and I live on the Clear Creek. My farm's on the Clear Creek side. But I have always fed my own cattle and always put up my own hay.
Now, you put up hay when you were young.
Well, no, we put up fodder. We didn't have any hay.
Didn't have any hay. Just
we took and
how'd you put up the fodder?
Well, what we would do, we we would grow this corn and these little small bottoms up there in Floyd County. And we would check the corn, and that would be that we'd plow one way with a laying off plow. And then we would plow the opposite way, and wherever those two rows crossed, that's where we planted the corn with a little jobber that you put in your hand and you fill it full of corn and
drop the corn.
Then 5 grains would normally come up, and then we would go back through there and thin it. And then we would plow it with a mule and a double shovel plow, and then we would cut the balk in the middle, and then we would hill it up twice. Well, that's healing it up would be bringing dirt up around it. Mm-hmm. And we grew about 65 bushel to the acre, which was good.
Did you
because we didn't have fertilizer, the bottoms overflowed every year. And in fact, I don't even think I knew anything about fertilizer. But the bottoms overflow and left this new layer, I guess something similar to what the Nile River did from the history that I've read. But anyway, we grew good corn there. We grew enough to, you know, live on up there. But when the corn got so big, you could only plow it one way. Mm-hmm. And that was usually the long way. The bottoms were usually long and narrow. And over here now, you asked me how we put up. What we did, we grew the corn, and we went through and we pulled the corn off and piled it in piles about 40, 50 feet apart and just threw the corn down on the ground and shucked it and threw it down by hand. Yeah. Then we'd come through there with a team and a sled, a team sled. It was a big sled, no wheels with runners on it. The runners were made out of white oak. And then when we'd load up this corn, we'd gather this corn after it frosted, we let it lay there. But what we did before we pulled the corn off, we would go through before the corn got too yellow, and we would cut the tops out of the stalk. And then we would tie that up, and we would haul it. We'd haul it in. And no, we would carry it in. We'd have to carry it out of the field because we couldn't take a sled in. Then before that, we pulled the ear off the corn, then we would, before it fired up at the bottom and got completely brown, it was still green. Then we stripped the leaves down to the ground, and we tied them up and tucked them to the barn and put them in a loft.
And used them for feed, too.
And used that fodder for roughage like they do now with hay. Mm-hmm. And then we went back and got the corn. So when we got the tops off of the corn, and then we stripped the leaves off the stalk, the only thing left in the field was the stalk right where the corn was, and the corn turned down, hanging down. And then we went through and shucked the corn and threw it in piles, and then we hauled it and we put it in a corn crib.
Now, did you use these tops for feed?
The tops was same as fodder. It was we used it for feed. We used it for what people use hay for today, and our cattle stayed fat. They milk good on that. Then when spring would come and we have a cow that was getting ready to come fresh with a calf, my granddaddy, it would be a big truck would come through from Ohio, and he would buy 5 or 6 of those 150-pound square bales of hay off of those trucks, which that's very little hay for a cow. But what it would do, it would give her the strength and keep her milking good when she...
Until that green grass...
Until the grass got there. But I would always want him to buy 200 or 300 bales, and he never would buy but 6 or 8 or 10. And I was the one doing the milking, and I was really interested in my cows getting that hay. And we fed it out about 4 inches a block at a time, along with the fodder.
Just enough to keep her strong enough
to milk good.
Huh.
No, thank you. Just stop by to see.
Well, now what do you?
What we do now, we have farm tractors, and we cut with a mower machine, a 7-foot mower machine, and when we rake it with a side delivery New Holland rake, and we either round bale or square bale. Now I do some of both.
Which one do you prefer?
Well, I like the work taken out of the round bale. You know, there's no work to the round bale. But I like the square bales the best. It costs you the most.
Why do you like them?
Because if you have a round bale and you put it out there, the bottom of the round bale rottens.
Oh, does it?
And you'll lose probably a foot off the bottom on a 1,000-pound roll. They say 1,000-pound. And then you lose about 6 inches all the way around to where it's sealing, and the inside of it should stay good. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't.
But I thought it had to rot somewhere.
And then the cows come in and they walk on and mess on more than what they eat. And when you put a square bale in the barn, which is about a 65-pound bale, and you put it in the barn, let it get dry before you bale it, and you put it in there, then they eat every blade of it.
You don't lose any of it,
but you've got a high labor cost. I suspect it would cost 20 to 25 cents a bale after you bale it to get it in the barn and labor. And you're going to have about $1 a bale in your own hay.
So you can really afford to lose it if you have a lot. When you're talking about
The round bales, yeah.
Yeah, you can afford.
That's the way people look at it.
It.
It's the way people look at it. I just don't feel like you have the quality of hay
that you do.
Now a lot of that's dependent upon season. You know, if you have a dry season like we've had this year, there wouldn't be as much rotting, and the hay would have a tendency to cure out and seal itself and not get as wet when it did rain as it would if you cut it and before it kind of sealed itself and matted over that. Hail kind of, the sun burns it, and then it kind of
seals
it, I guess, like the grass roofs of England, you know, they used the thatch roof in England. That bale of hay is supposed to work that way, except you've got both ends open, too, so.
Yeah. It just seemed like to me,
but
of course, we'd never done it.
Anyway, my farm, and I have a furniture store and farm, too. I can't really say that I've really made any money at farming. Much, but I've always been healthy, and I've always loved to do hard work and do that type of work. And I wouldn't be classified as a full-time farmer.
There aren't many of those.
In that area, I doubt if there's only two people on that creek that farms that I know that's got enough farm to make a good living. So, but I do know about farming, and I think I'm extremely good cattle man.
And what you kind asked of cattle?
Me the cattle I like. I started out with Hereford, and I didn't think the Hereford milked enough. And I prefer myself, just my own preference. I prefer a half Hereford and a half Angus cow, and either come back with a Hereford bull or an Angus bull. And what you do, you get a hybrid cow. You get a cow that milks better, I think. And the buyers seem to prefer the black cattle. They'll pay more money for the black cattle with white faces than they'll pay for about anything else.
Hmm. And was the beef that much better?
Well, I do a lot of reading. I take the Farm Journal and I take the Progressive Farmer. And I have read to where if you take a straight breed of cow, like an Angus, which is black, or a straight breed of cow, which is a red-white face, which is a Hereford. And if you take and cross those, you create what the offspring is what you call a hybrid. And that by crossing the two of them, your calves will weigh 20% more.
You get the best of both of them.
You get the best of both breeds. You have the genetic thing in there is that you have a tendency to pick up all the good things and lose all the bad things when you mix the two breeds over either breed. And then you can come back if you want to. You would probably do better if you didn't. If you had an offspring as a brood cow, like a black white faced cow, you would probably be better off to come back with a Simmental bull or a Charolais bull or a brown Swiss bull even. And then you'd get a triple hybrid. Now, when you get beyond that, you just about have to be a college professor that majored in animal husbandry to understand that. Because when you get so far along, then you can start picking up these bad qualities instead of the good ones. But that's simple enough that you can go three ways with hybrid animals. And that's the reason I prefer them. They're more hearty to start with when you mix them. Now, my own particular version of cattle, if there wasn't but one breed of beef cattle, it'd have to be the Angus.
Why is that?
Because the Angus doesn't take as much to eat during the winter. It's a hardy animal. They all milk good. They have good udders on them, and they don't break down in the udders, and they just got a lot of vigor. This is my opinion now. I'm not an expert. This is what I believe, okay? It's not fact, but and they're easier kept, and they have small calves, and they don't have as much calving problems as most other animals do. Like,
but now, Charolais, have you
well, I've had some trouble with Charolais that you have to pull them. The calves would be too big. And I'm sure that there's probably some breeds of Charolais that you don't have to pull, but every one ever I had that come from a Charolais bull, most of them we had to pull. And I had a Simmental bull one year, and I had to pull about five calves.
I hate to ask, but what is that?
That's when you have to help deliver.
No, I mean the Simmental.
Why?
No, what
is
are
it?
They?
Yeah, it's a fresh breed of cattle that is the size of Charolais, but not as big around in the body and not as big in the hips. And they're supposed to be a vigorous, exotic breed. They come from France.
What do they look like?
They are red and white. They're cuttered up like a Guernsey, only they're big animals.
Okay,
and they're the longest breed of animals made. And then if there's going to only be one breed of milk cow, it'd have to be the Holstein because they produce the most milk. Not necessarily the most butter, but the most milk. So, in my opinion, that's the two breeds you'd have to have. But when you cross them up, in fact, I even like Holstein for a half Holstein for a mother, for a cow also, because you pick up a lot of milk, and then that calf lives off that milk for the. And I sell baby beef. See, I don't take and grain them. I get them up to 450 to 650 pound, and take. They're still nursing the cow, and then I sell them with the milk fat on them. So I want a cow
that's going to produce
enough milk, but not be a cow that I can't keep fat. Now some of these Holstein cattle, that milk's so heavy, they require so much feed that even though you sell a bigger calf, you've also put more in them because it costs you more to win them. Now that's one reason why I like Angus. I think an Angus cow will stay fatter. She's got smaller bone and a smaller compact frame, and they normally look fatter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can almost sell them any time of the year. Now, your big bone cattle and your big frame cattle, they have to be on grass for 90 days, good grass for 90 days, in order to have enough meat on them to look good.
To look good.
Yeah.
Okay. Have you ever crossed the Charolais and Angus?
Yes, I have.
Did you have calving problems there?
Well, if I was going to do it, I think I'd look, if I were going to go in that direction, I think what I'd probably want would be Charolais cows with an Angus bull. Instead of the Charolais bull and the Angus cows, I'd be getting the offspring you get on that is, we call it a mousy color, and you know, color like a mouse, kind of a brown, and the buyers like that color. The buyers up north, they like that color. They like that color next. They like Charolais mixed at the stockyards. The people that's going to buy cattle and feed them out, they like Charolais. They don't like them straight as well. In my opinion, and I've been told this and I've observed this, that the Charolais would bring the most money if you were selling papers, you know, because she'd have to be white with pink skins. But the buyers like them mixed.
Hmm.
They like them mixed.
Realize that's the best beef.
Yeah, that's what I think now. I mean, I'm not the expert, but that's what my background teaches me, you know. That's what I believe, you know, and I don't know.
Well, you've had the experience.
So I'm not bragging on one breed of cattle over another. I'm just telling you what I like.
Well, I think Angus, a few years ago, all the beef cattle were Angus. You know, everyone wanted to grow Angus.
Well, they've been awfully popular. The first popular cattle was the Hereford for years and years and years, which was brought here by Henry Clay. He brought the first Hereford cattle, and then the Angus, I think, got to be pop, maybe the last 20 years, I'd say the Angus has certainly been.
And now
of the straight breeds, it's the most, it's still preferred for a straight breed by most people, I think.
But most beef,
at least by me,
beef farmers now are mixing those breeds to get rid of that veterinarian bill, a lot of it, so they don't have near as much problems. Do you find that true also?
Well, I think what the farmer's trying to do, if he knows his cattle pretty good, he's able to help a cow, a calf, and he would rather take a chance on getting a big one, and it grow off big, and him selling maybe 150 pounds more baby beef
than he would. We were talking about cattle. What are these herds of cattle I see out in the fields that are black in the front and black in the back and white in the center?
White ring around them. I tell you, I've been told twice, and I can't tell you, except I can tell you that they're an English breed. And I haven't seen any that look any better than what we have, other than the fact that just an...
Unusual, very unusual looking.
In my opinion, you know, these may be, you know, they may be fantastic cattle. I don't know because I haven't had any experience with them. But any time that you go for color, you're going to lose something. Okay. Like in the Hereford, I think that they went for the white head and the white stripe on the shoulder and the white tip on their tail and the white underneath their tail and the white feet and the white stomach, you know, down on the bottom side. And I think they worried too much about color. Now that's my opinion.
And they may have lost.
And I think they lost some confirmation on the Angus cattle by breeding them, by them being black, and I think that they might have paid more attention to how straight the back leg was and how much length they had and what type of head they had on them. And,
as opposed to how soon you could fatten them.
And I don't think they worried about color other than the fact they wanted black ones. And there's also a red Angus too, you know.
Well, I've heard of them, but I haven't seen them.
They used to.
I don't recognize.
Yeah, there's a breed registered in this country called red Angus.
Is it a good beef?
It's about the same thing. It's just a deep shade of red. They look just like Angus, only they're a deep shade of red instead of being black. And I would have to guess they're probably just as good, because I don't think color's that important.
Makes it much different.
I think color's important around the eyes, because I think cattle that has some color in them other than white have less tendency to have pink eye and the eye diseases that we have, like when the grass is tall and the seeds are up and they're grazing and getting the chaff and infection around the eyes. I think the ones that have the darker skin and the darker eyes do better.
Well, Charlay, some of the farmers have said that Charlay you have a lot of problems with Charlay with pink eye.
Well, I'm not an expert on Charlay. I can tell you this, they are pretty cattle. The only thing about a Charlay, the only thing you have to worry about is getting it here. If you get it here, I don't think there's anything any better.
Anything that can bother it after that.
Because they really muscle up well and they really are
big.
Growthy.
Yeah, they look good. Well, these cattle I was talking about, are they new or fairly new to the United States?
Well, I've just seen them here lately, and I'd say they're just trying to get established. See,
are they beef?
They're a beef type animal, yes.
Okay.
I'd have to think that, I do know Carolyn Orr, that's a herdswoman at Berea College, and I haven't talked with her. In fact, I can't even tell you the name of those cattle that you're talking about. But I've talked with her, and they've got a hybrid program at Berea College, which they have hundreds of brood cows and four or five different breeds, and they're crossbreeding. And Carolyn Orr's favorite is, right now, Carolyn, she had a master's degree and part of a doctor's degree from the University of Tennessee, and she bought and sold all of their feeder cattle for them before she came to Berea, and she stayed at Berea College like 3 or 4 years, and right now she's getting her doctor's degree in Texas, and then she'll be coming back here. I know her fairly well, and I have respect for her knowledge. And Carolyn seems to think that the Simmental has about as much to offer. I don't know if you need 100 breeds of cattle. You know, I don't know that you don't need them either, but I think you can take the basic cattle that we've always had around Madison County here. That's Holstein and Holstein mix with and Hereford and Hereford mixed cattle and Angus cattle, and take a Simmental and a Charolais and get about what you want in hybrid growth, I'd think. But I'm not an expert on that. And I have been asked that question so many times.
I just wondered because, what they were.
But I'll tell you the truth, I do not know the name of those cattle. I don't know how good they are, but...
I've only seen a couple of herds.
I've seen... a friend of mine has two up here on his farm, and they don't look any better to me. They may not look as good as his other cattle to me. But I just wouldn't think the color and that exotic type coloring and going with uniformity would be...
That much better?
Only thing it'd be, it just might be attractive. For color. I just think that y'all think about quality. When you ask me about what type of cow I like a cow that's long and off the ground and got a lot of body to her or it. And I understand that in the early days of judging cattle, especially with the Angus and the Hereford cattle, they wanted a cow or a steer to look as much like a box as you can get it, as square as you can get it, low on the ground and short and wide. Short heads and wide heads, which is... because for some reason they went strictly for what they wanted to look at. Well, then, as time went by, they kept breeding these cattle, and you got this wide head and short wide head and these little fat bodies, and these cows had difficulty in calving, and they ended up with some dwarfism in both breeds, you know, the standard breeds we've always known, the Hereford and the Angus. Now, this is what I understand, my opinion. And then they got to looking at the big cattle that was in Europe that had been left alone and that had gone more for size, and the cow with the long, narrow head had less trouble calving than a calf that had a wide, short head. And so they changed. Now they want cattle to be rectangular, like a shoebox. They want one that's long and off the ground, and our perception or our wants in the cattle industry. Now, the people that's made the most strides, to my knowledge, is the people called Beefmaster people, which I do not know exactly where they originated. I know they originated in the Midwest. And they cared nothing about what color something was. They were interested in how much grain that you fed them and how much beef that you put on them with that much grain. And they kept records on these cattle. And whichever one grew the best, those are the ones they took and made sires out of. And these sires, in turn, sired the cattle that are growthy and quick growing. And they have also done the same thing in the straight breeds. I mean, we went into Canada and we couldn't bring the cattle in, these big bulls. They had a big breed of black cattle up there called Colossal. And Colossal was a huge black Angus breed. And they wouldn't let them bring the cattle in, so they brought the semen in from this Colossal. Now, there might have been other bulls, but he's the one that's more or less they contribute to increasing the size of the black cattle. And I do not know what the name of the ones he did, but they've done the same thing. And they've got the Hereford cattle just about as big as anything now, and they've got the straight Angus cattle. Now, me buying locally, I classify... I guess you can tell by my talk that in my conversation, I really like an Angus. I really like Angus cattle. And
what about beef? I want to buy an Angus. Yeah,
there's three sizes of Angus cattle. There's a little Angus cattle that's small and dwarfy that people around the stockyards and myself, we call them Doty cattle.
Doties.
Little Doty cattle. Mm-hmm. And then there's the middle-sized, a little bit bigger black. They're all Angus cattle. And then we have the bigger breed, and most of those bigger breeds now, they've got these Angus cattle weighing over 2,000 pounds, and used to, you know, it was hard to get an Angus bull to weigh 1,300-1,400 pounds unless you just put him on straight corn and fed him till he popped, you know. But now they've got these big black cattle that goes up to 2,700 pounds, and that's getting to be a pretty good sized animal. Now the cows are getting to be 1,300-1,500 instead of 600-800. So they've made, now I'm not, you know, I don't want to paint myself up as being the expert, but I have had something like 20-some years experience of fooling with beef cattle, plus my childhood years of fooling with dairy cattle, and I don't know, the University of Kentucky and the performance games that they put out, and people like Purdue University and Northwestern University and probably Ohio, you know, your Corn Belt people, they can teach you more, you know, through their experiments than what you can learn in a lifetime. And the best way to learn about cattle or to get informed about it, I think, is by reading what's published. You know, you can sit at
and
home.
And trying it out on your own.
Like the statistic I got on these mixing of the Hereford and Angus cattle, I read that years ago, and I think it was done at Northwestern University.
And then
I tried it, and I got away from the straight Hereford cattle and got more milk from my cows, and I was selling baby beeves. And it seemed like I did better, and the best cattle I ever had was when I had the black, white-faced cattle. And then I used a half Simmental, half Hereford bull, and I got a chocolate-looking calf that was marked up like a Hereford. I took 16 to the market. Baby beefs, and the 16 averaged 600 and some pounds off the calf, and that's a pretty good calf.
Mm,
you know, most times 300 or 400 pounds off of a cow that you haven't crit fed or fed corn is a normal size. So I didn't keep those cattle because the cattle market went sour, and I got out of them. I got depressed because I saw cattle go from 79 cents a pound to 11, 12 cents a pound, and I got disgusted and I got out of them. But I always wished that I had kept, I started this little experiment of my own on what I'd read of mixing cattle, and I had a three-way cross there, and I had some good cattle, and I just wish I'd have kept the best cattle I ever owned. This was several years ago, the first fall. I guess it's been 8 or 9 years since I've had those. I don't, you know, time has a tendency to get away from you, and y'all get all jammed up, you know, and you think it's been 6 years and it's been 10 or 12.
Oh, yes, I know that.
But anyway, I did have that, and I had 62 head, and I just wish I had a kept. If I was disgusted, I wish I had only been disgusted enough to sell part of them.
Well, did you sell completely out then, or?
I sold completely out, and that was when Secretary Butts got up and said, well, it's a simple reason why that the price of beef is so high, and they put a freeze on it at 79 cents a pound. And I had 30-some head to sell.
Has it been that long?
And I think it was 72 or 3. I can't remember exactly, you know. But anyway, he said there's simply not enough brood cows or not enough mothers to raise enough calves to feed the American people, and therefore we're going to put a freeze on it. So they put a freeze on it, and I said, well, heck, boy, I'm not going to take 79 cents for my cattle. That when they take that freeze off, they'll bring $1, $1.50. And so I knew it wasn't going to stay on there long, so I held my cattle. Well, then the housewives got mad, and they had the little boycott. You remember that?
Yes.
And they were boycotting meat. Then when they did take the freeze off, the bottom fell out of it, and it dropped about 36 cents a pound. And then I said, I had a partner at that time. I said, I'm not going to take that for my cattle. I said, are you? He said, no. So I kept them till that fall and up into the winter. And I had more cattle than I had grass. And then I was having to buy corn, and I was putting more money in them. And, you know, you reach a limitation. Well, you can reach a limitation of what your little farm will carry, and I had mine. I had mine overloaded, so it finally got to the point, you know, I thought that the thing would change. And it did change. It took a couple of years, but I couldn't hold for a couple of years, so I sold some cattle for 11 and 16 cents a pound that had I sold them. And then Secretary of Agriculture Butts got up and said, well, it's a simple reason why that that the meat is so cheap is because that there's more beef than there is people to eat it. Well, now, he made this statement 6 months apart, you know, and if you ever raised any cattle, you know it takes a cow has to be about 2 years old.
6 months is not a long time.
Yeah, about 2 years old to get with a calf, and it takes her 9 months to have one. So somewhere or other, we got a difference. In 6 months, some way that cow market got turned all the way around from too many cows to not enough cows.
Not enough cows.
So I learned right then that the time to sell, and I have nothing against Mr. Butts for saying it, because the Secretary of Agriculture's business is to feed the American people as cheap as you can. I found out later. It's not to help the farmer.
Whose and job is it to help the farmer?
I don't know if it's anybody's. It's his own, I guess, you know, private enterprise. But anyway, I found out this, the best time to sell is when they're ready to sell.
Right. That's when
and you got your cattle fat, and you're going to overload your grass if you keep them, and they're ready to go. If they're bringing 25 cents or bringing 75 cents a pound, that's time to sell them, whatever. You know, you can't, I can't be smart enough to figure out when the cattle are going to be high and when they're going to be low, and if I could, I'd be a multi-billionaire.
Well, if you could, you have to hold on to.
Yeah.
And like you said,
you'd have to
overload it.
When you hold on to them, you start putting more money in them.
Mm-hmm.
Then you're taking a chance on maybe getting an increase, but you're also taking a chance in getting a decrease in price. So the time to sell them is like tobacco. People tell me, said, man, I want to sell my tobacco in the third week of the sale. And I say, well, why do you want to sell it? Well, they start out good. And then they get a little better every week to encourage you to bring it in. It seems to me like the best time to sell it is the third week. And then I've heard other people say, I always want to sell it on the second week. Well, I'll tell you when I want to sell it. I want to sell it when we get it stripped and we get it in the barn before somebody breaks in and steals it.
Right.
I want to load mine up and take it over there, and there's not going to be a difference but 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 cents on the pound. And I want it out of my barn, and I want the money, and I want to think about next year's little tobacco crop.
Right.
And I feel the same way about cattle. When you got a calf that's fat and you got a cow that's getting close to calving again, you either have to sell that cow or you have to sell that calf.
Mm-hmm. You can't hold on to
both. So I say the time to sell it is when it's time to sell it, you know.
Not
try to be like me and figure I'm going to get a dollar a pound for something that I ended up taking 16 cents a pound for.
You must have lost a fortune on those.
Well, it wasn't a fortune, but it was a big piece of money to me because I'm not that big anyway, but it was several thousand dollars.
Yeah, well, that's fortune.
Yeah.
That's a fortune to me. Well, now, do you live on a farm now?
No, I live in a subdivision outside of Berea in the county, a place called Dogwood Heights Subdivision.
Does anyone live on the farm?
Yes, I have a man that lives on the farm. He works with the Berea Sanitation Department. That's back to proof that the people like to live on the farm and work in Berea. In fact, that whole sanitation department of Berea is made up of people off of Clear Creek.
Huh.
I'd say there's more there than there is from Berea.
People live on the farm.
They don't live out, and they own a little piece of land, or they grow a little tobacco for somebody and work in town, too.
Well, do you have any problem with people stealing?
I've never had anything stolen over there other than maybe some gas out of tractors or some diesel fuel.
Never had any cattle?
I've never had any cattle stolen, but I have had a lot of trouble with dogs.
Wild dogs or just community dogs
community dogs that pack up and run, and what they'll do, they'll run a cow until she gets so hot that she just lays down, and then they'll eat her up. And once they find out, and also they'll disturb a cow when she's calving. Once they start running cattle and never kill one, you know, they've got this animal in them. And I've got a neighbor over there that's got, well, and everybody around me's got about four dogs too many.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a dog over there, but I do have a man living there, but the farm covers some hillside, and he couldn't always tell if there was a dog chasing one. But I've had a lot of trouble with dogs. I've had several cows killed and several calves killed, and I run off the cliff because dogs were after one.
And, well, do you have insurance on those, or do you just take a loss on those?
Well, I have had a time, but the insurance is high, and right now I don't have any cattle. I sold my cattle out, except for I've got three cows and two calves and a big Simmental bull over here at Middletown. I've got Here in town, I've got a little 13-acre farm here in town also, in Madison County.
Are you going to get back in, or?
Well, what I usually do is sell out. I maybe need the money for something else at that particular time. I needed some money, so if you got cattle, it's always a source of money.
Back.
So when, well, I need for, you know, to pay.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
There's
well,
money
yeah, there's always a source of money when you've got cattle. So what I'll try to do, I've sold the cattle, a big part of them, and now I'll start picking up one or two at a time as I have the money to do that. I'll take part of my tobacco money, which is probably won't be that much, probably be $1,600-$1,800 worth, and I'll buy a few head out of that and keep the rest of the money. But
how much do you have to pay for a head of cattle when you're starting a herd like this?
Well, what you know, it's all, that's depend upon the price of cattle at the time you ask that question. Right now, you can take about $475, $450 and buy a good cow to carry. Not necessarily a registered cow to calf, but a young cow with a good calf on her. And from that to $550. And if you buy a cow that doesn't have a calf, you ought to get her for in a high 200s or low 300s.
And this is a good beef.
Well, it'd be something that I'd want for a mother to raise beef with,
yeah,
and I'd always, I normally always use a purebred bull, say.
And well, if you were, say, a young person starting out, could you afford to go buy that farm now and stock it?
No,
and
you can
start farming, get another source of income?
I really don't think so. I think you'd have to have a father that had a farm and had machinery, and that you might become partners with him, or he might buy in with you and have start with you know, somebody starting out, unless they had a bankroll, they wouldn't lend them the money unless you had, you know, a good portion of it. And the way interest is, I don't think that you could buy any farm today, I don't care how big a farm you are, and pay the interest. Right now interest is 13.5% here in Berea. I don't think you can make 13.5% on any farm in the United States. If you count your investment, you know. Now, if you are a farmer's son and you inherit a farm and you inherit the machinery, then you can keep that farm and not have to cap that interest. You can make it, and then when you get through, when you live your lifetime, you can turn it over to one of your sons and he can make it. But if you go out here and you had to buy the farm equipment and had to buy the cattle and had to buy the farm and had to pay 13.5% interest on it, I think it'd take you just a couple of years to go broke.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care how good a farmer you was and how much you worked.
You just couldn't live, could you?
I don't think you can. Now, I'm not an expert on that again, but they'd have to be a whole lot better farmer than I am to even think about it, let alone do it.
If you had, you had 200 acres, and you have to stock it. You don't have to pay interest on the land. You inherited it. But you have to stock it, and you have to buy the machinery. Could you make it then?
Well, yeah, you can buy the stock, but what you need to do is let somebody have part of it and let them furnish machinery. And if I was trying to give you a piece of advice or anybody else a piece of advice, unless you're going to be doing the farming yourself, I'd say y'all never own a piece of machinery because it's expensive. Now, if I were getting down to when I come back out of the Army in 62 and I bought that little farm over there for almost nothing, and then I tiled it and fenced it and rebuilt the barn and put a foundation on it and put seven new posts in it. And I hired a bulldozer to clean the creek out to keep the creek from washing through my farm when it got up big. And then I remodeled a house and put a bathroom and stuff in it. I had this money saved up and bought it for almost nothing. Well, that same farm today will probably bring 8 or 9 times that price. And it's a better farm now.
Mm-hmm.
It probably doesn't look all that much better because I haven't been a good farmer myself the last. I have mowed it off too. I'll take that back. I have mowed off, cut hay off of it. But what you'd want to do is to stay out of the machinery business unless you were operating yourself and you were just running the farm yourself. And even if you were buying the farm, I'd hesitate on buying a lot of machinery. I'd probably, unless you put up an awful lot of hay, it doesn't pay you to have a hay baler. Now, you'd probably have to have a tractor and something to mow it with and keep it clean with, and a set of plows to maybe something, but you wouldn't have to get into combines. And well, in this area, we don't have combines anyway.
Really. Yeah. So what I wondered, if just a young person could do it, if they could even, if they could borrow the money, could they pay it back off the farm?
As I said, I'm not the expert, but I'd say no. My opinion, no.
Well, what's going to happen to all of our farmland? A lot of farmers are going out of business. Not like you, but farmers that are living on that farm to make a living, they're not making it. What's going to happen to
I read an article, I don't remember what magazine, it was probably the Farm Journal, 2 or 3 years ago, something about some farmland that was milk land that had been drained in Virginia, and it was peanut land. Mm. They grew peanuts there. Somewhere around Norfolk, between the coast, there's always a dip in there. Mm-hmm. It was almost coast, and they drained that land. And the people couldn't make it, and they were small farmers, probably a lot larger than I am, but they were small farmers. And then a conglomerate goes in there and buys it up. And instead of him farming 60 acres or 100 acres, he's farming 10,000 acres. And he's big enough that he can grow what he wants to grow, and he can go to Planters Peanuts and say, now look, I'm going to have a certain price for peanuts, and if I can do this, if I guarantee you that I'll have so many, I guess, tons of peanuts, what price can I get this fall? And he can sit down and figure out what he can make off of that. What he done figured out what he has to have out of that, how they sell peanuts. We don't grow them here, but I think that farming eventually will go just like everything else. I think the trend is for small businesses like my furniture store is for me to fade out or get larger. You know, maybe you'd have to start at the size I am or smaller in order to get larger. Mm-hmm. Unless you were a conglomerate like Dolly Madison Cakes bought into the furniture business, or like Philip Morris diversifies in these things. They don't start out small, but they diversify, and they look into what they can make out of it before they buy into it. You know, they've got good analysis, and they probably have all the computer information that's available, and they know where they want to go. And if they're in the furniture business and they don't think the furniture business is going to be good in the next 10 years of making furniture, then they'll sell the furniture business and they'll buy into the food business or what have you, or the coal business, as an example. Most all the coal and a tremendous amount of coal in the state of Kentucky is owned by foreign and outside interests outside the state.
Well, and that's something else. Our farmers going to be like that?
Well, I just think the trend is for everything to get big. See what happens. See, the farmer never would organize. If he'd ever organized like labor, and I'm not a big labor person, but he never did organize. But everybody else that built cars or refrigerators, they organized, and then they bargained for their wages. And the thing that's kept the farmer back all through these years that he never would organize, because he's independent. It's like if you've got 100 acres and you got more hogs than that 100 acres and you can feed, you can't keep them. Well, it's not like storing up cars or storing up metal or something that's not perishable or something that doesn't have to be cared for, you know. And the farmer, he's just an independent fella anyway. It's like me, my little operation, I don't much want somebody to tell me what to do or, you know, what I do. But if the farmer ever organized, I think it might end up being bad for the, it would be good for him, but it might end up being bad for the country.
But it would probably be better for the farmer.
It'd probably be better. I look at it like this, and my own version, that you got a totem pole. You know, mm-hmm. It's like the Indians carved out with a hatchet or a knife or tomahawk or whatever he used, which the West Coast Indians did this mostly, I think. They had their spirits and their gods on this totem pole, or their famous people in their tribe somewhere in there. You know, if they had a famous chief, they put his head on this totem pole. Well, I look at labor as a totem pole, and at the top of the totem pole, you've got your strong unions, which is your longshoresmen and your meat packers and your AFL-CIO people. At one time, United Mine Workers, then you get the business people and And as you come down and lay right on the bottom, that the farmer is. And the reason why I say that, and I'm, and again, I'm not an expert. I just got a fool's opinion, probably. But when I was a boy, you could buy hay for a dollar a bale. Mm-hmm. When I got to be a grown man, you could buy hay for a dollar a bale. I'm 52 years old. You can still buy hay for a dollar a bale.
Right.
Okay. And you could buy corn for a dollar and a quarter a bushel. Well, now corn's five bushels a barrel. You can buy corn now for about, last year it was about $11 a barrel. They're predicting that corn will be $15 a barrel. So that's $3 a bushel. But you turn around and all of his seed is everything that he uses is fertilizer. When I started farming, I'll use this little example. I could have bought a hay baler and a rake for $2,100 when I started farming from Parsons Implement, which would have been a Massey Ferguson. It would have been a New Holland rake, which is the Spear Rand owns that corporation. And I could have bought a rake and a baler, just the same, basically the same thing they're using today, for $2,100 for both. Mm-hmm. Now the rake's $3,700 and the baler's $5,600. Well, he's still getting the same money for that hay, but you look at what he's doing now. You could buy all the diesel fuel you wanted for 18, 19 cents a gallon at that time. Mm-hmm. Now the diesel fuel is $1.04 to $1.06 to $1.10. So how could he be better? Now that's just one item. Like there's a hay baler and there's hay. Then you turn back around and tobacco's bringing, and they say, well, we're going to have $2 tobacco. Boy, that's a lot of money for tobacco. But when I first started growing tobacco brought 65 to 68 cents a pound. And you could buy fertilizer for $14, $16, and $20 a ton. Well, now fertilizer is $150, $180 a ton, $200 for ammonia nitrate, which you use on tobacco. So that's gone up how many times, say? Now, it averages out, the things that I could mention would average out about six. So if you wanted to take what tobacco ought to be in proportion to what machinery is costing farmers today, tobacco ought to bring six times 68 cents.
Right.
Now they're talking about big to money on tobacco, and it's bringing $2. So, well, he's making less money
than when I started,
he's making less money. You could buy a tractor. 30-some horsepower tractor, 36 to 40 horsepower tractor, and that's what we need in this country. You can buy a tractor for $3,000, a diesel tractor. Now a diesel tractor, I bought a Ford last year, and it lived for $13,600. I traded, so I guess I've got $13,600 in it, you know. Now, used to, you could buy a mowing machine for $375, a dyno-balanced mowing machine. That's a belt-driven mowing machine that doesn't have a pitman arm, doesn't have a wooden pitman arm on it. Works off of two wheels and a belt. They don't break as easy, and they run smoother. That's a rear-mounted mower that goes on your tractor. The first one I bought, I paid $375 for it. $300, and I bought the Dynabalance, which the Dynabalance and the New Holland and the John Deere, in my opinion, are the three good mowing machines. Now, there may be others, but I've had all three of those. I still have an old Dynabalance now. I sold the one I had, the first one I paid $375, and it was still a good mowing machine. I bought a John Deere mowing machine 2 months ago, and it lists for $2,550. Now, I ended up trading around, and I figure that I've got $2,550 in that John Deere mowing machine. Now, it's nice, but if you take $375 and multiply that into, you know, I don't have a calculator, and I'm not
divide
that quick.
It in. It's about then 7 times.
All right,
more.
Then tobacco ought to bring 6 or 7 times.
What it does,
and so should hay. Now hay still brings the same price. Corn might be up twice, maybe
which
two and a half times.
Doesn't come near to the price.
Now you turn around to your taxes and your insurance. Now when the people were farming 25 or 30 years ago, they were raising most of what they've got. Most farmers today go to the grocery store and buy what they want. You know, I grow a garden because I like to grow a garden because I like
the fresh food.
My wife's breaking up green beans over right now that come out of my garden, and our garden, I would say. But we like fresh stuff out of the garden, and I know what we put on it. We don't put a lot of chemicals on it. And
you grow it because you like it.
Because I like it, and because the quality of the food's good, and I know there's no poison on that.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not sure that everything else got poison on it either, but I'm suspicious that it might.
Feel better about your own.
But anyway, if they wanted the farmer to do good, then they would keep the price of what he's selling in relation to the price of what he's buying. That would be diesel fuel and the equipment he used, and even the price of land. Now, I bought this little farm I've got right now. The little farm that I've got right now, I bought it for $8,500. And I suspected it would bring more than 50. I don't know exactly.
I would think so.
But anyway, you have to figure, if you figure the interest on the money on the land, I could probably sell the farm for what it'd bring today and put it in the bank on a CD and probably make twice or three times as much money and not hit a lick of nothing. In fact, that's why I sold the other farm for it.
Talking about the interest on the farms. A man told me yesterday he had $300,000 tied up in his dairy farm. He could sell it, put the money in the bank, live on the interest, never hit another lick more.
And make more money than his milk.
Live a lot better.
Yeah. Well, that's true. That's the reason why I sold that one farm. Now, the farm I've got left over right now, I've got a sentimental. If I'd really looked to approach it just as a business venture, I'd sell it right now. But it's like somebody told me one time, you know, like I told somebody one time, he said, well, why don't you sell that and put it in? That's when the CD, didn't have any money to buy any CDs during this high CD thing, which I'm not complaining about that. I don't own one. I don't own one, you know, and didn't own one during any of that. But so why don't you sell that damned old farm and take the money and put it on CDs up there and get 17% when you're trying to make 2 or 3 or 4% off your investment,
mm-hmm.
plus the aggravation, plus the taxes, plus nailing the barn doors back on, plus fixing the tracks on the barn, plus mowing it off, plus cleaning the fence rows
and fencing,
and plus keeping it painted, plus the pump breaking down and putting a new pump, your general maintenance or your plumbing and what have you on the farm, and the fertilizer. So why in the hell don't you just do that? Well, I guess I didn't really have any argument. The only argument I can think of is that you can't walk on money.
Right.
You know, you can't walk on money, and money doesn't have a stream on it, and money doesn't have a tree on it, and cattle don't walk on money, and they can't eat money. You know.
That's right. Keeping a lot of farmers? Small farmers.
I'd say the only way that you can afford to farm today is because you really like to. Now, again, I'm a small farmer. I'm not an Illinois farmer that's farming 500 or 600 acres or 1,000, and I'm not an Iowa farmer. I'm just got a little small farm over here, mostly covered up with timber. And
how much timber do you have over here?
Well,
percentage wise,
about 80% of my farm is timber, hillside.
Is it good timber?
Yeah, there's some good timber on it. We've been offered a pretty good piece of money for it.
Now, again, that's money in the bank.
Yeah, if you don't get a fire in it, but if you don't sell it, which we haven't sold it, and I don't think we will, because when you sell it, you know, you could get into erosion, and it takes so long to grow back. Plus, if you get a fire in there, the timber will be ruined. I mean, every year you keep it, you're taking a chance. Now, one reason I don't worry about fire much is because I joined the government, and the government, they're very particular about having fire out on their land.
Mm.
And by me joining them, they're not going to let a fire start on me and get on them, or they're not going to let one start on the other side of the hill and burn across them to get to me. So as a result, I don't have to worry as much as somebody that doesn't join the government. They've got 1,000 acres of my wife's grandfather's land that's got timber on that joins where I am and joins the farm that her daddy still owns.
So they're protecting you.
He sold some for 3.5 an acre and sold some for 7.5, and the most he got out of any of it was $10 an acre.
So you think a lot of it is like you, sentimental reasons, keeping these small farms.
I think that the people that farm has got in their blood, just like me coming off of a little old, really a 13-acre farm up in eastern Kentucky, and getting mud between my toes and
just liking and milking the feel a cow of that
and, farm. And not like not really liking it, but getting away from it and realize that you did like it and
that it was the best life you could have had.
I think there's things that, you know, we've got two streams of water. One place there, a quarter of a mile long, you can lay down in a branch and get you a drink of water that probably would have less bacteria than the city water we drink. Plus, we don't have no chlorine in it. Tastes better. It's fed by seven streams, runs over a little rocky gravel. It never dries up. If it doesn't rain, that little stream still runs. And if maybe some animal was in it, like a possum or a squirrel, but by the time it runs over so many rocks,
it's clean again.
It's clean again.
Cleaner than what?
In fact, the bacteria count during 1930, the dormitories in Brea College were all shut down, and people only had water so many hours a day because of the dry drought year that they had. And they went to Clear Creek, and they hauled water to Brea College to flush the commodes with in the dormitories from the water 9 miles from Brea, because there was water over there from those springs that run over those mountains, and we still have those. And there's nothing above them. There's nothing above them. There's no trash, no dumping, no garbage, no people, no toilets, no septic.
The government owns that up there.
The government owns that above us.
Yeah.
You know, and plus we own the valley. We own part of the hill in the valley, so we're protected. And by it being at the headwaters of this little Clear Creek, they call that little place over there the Loman Branch. Now, the water will always be clear as long as there's timber up there and as long as we own that and we don't have people in there with septic tanks and dishwater
and
garbage and rats that comes and follows the garbage and encephalitis and all that stuff. I mean, I've laid down over there many a time. If I was over there right now, I'd probably lay down on a rock and get me a big... And it's shaded and it's cold. It's not warm.
I did Sunday.
And in the wintertime, when most people that have ponds, when they're taking an axe and busting the pond every cold day twice to let the cattle drink, we don't have to go over there and burst no pond, because there's always a place where that water's running out. I don't care if it gets 20 below zero for a week. There's always somewhere for the cattle to drink. There's a 2 mile of creek there that they can get a drink anytime they want to. Now, certain sections of it will freeze over and it'll run out below, you know, but there'll be lots of places, yeah, and that's one reason it makes it such a good cattle farm.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
I mean, I just wish it were larger, you know, it's small.
Well, I thought it better come the same thing.
Now, you know, we've talked about the Clear Creek section of Rockcastle County, and I'm not an expert at Rockcastle, but I do know the end that joins Madison County. And the section that I'm in, of course, is Clear Creek section, and up on the hill there's a plateau called the Scaffold Cane section, which is richer red clay land that they grew wheat when they didn't have fertilizer. Then there's the best land in Rockcastle County would be west of Mount Vernon, which is Mount Vernon's a county seat. It's called Brennell Ridge. I couldn't think of it for a minute. And Brennell Ridge runs from a place called Conway over to Broadhead. And Broadhead has a little fire that's pretty famous. You know, they've had a fire going there over 100 years. It's Little World's Fire that's going on right now, as a matter of fact. And they have a horse show and a mule pulling contest, and they judge fruit and they judge cakes. And that's the best county fair around. And it's just like it was in the 30s, and the people flock in there. And then there's a section over next to Pulaski County that's good farmland. And then there's a lot of land in Rockcastle that's not productive because it's hillside, and it got its name right when they named it Rockcastle because there's an awful lot of limestone around Mount Vernon. Mm-hmm. And most of the ridges and the hills aren't flat, they're razorback, except for the Scaffold Cane area, which is a section that joins Madison here, and then the Brennell Ridge section. And then there's another section just before you get to Pulaski County. I think they call it Pine Hill, but I'm not sure about that in the county. But there is some good land over there, and there's some good farms over in there. And Rockcastle County probably will remain an agriculture type of county because it, they haven't been able to attract industry like, as an example, like Berea has and like Richmond has. Berea's been extremely fortunate in the past years, and Richmond's been extremely fortunate in attracting industry recently. At one time, we got here in Berea, through the efforts of my father-in-law, Bill Fennell, we got Goodyear Industrial Brake Company that's just a few hundred yards from this store building that we're talking in, and we got the Hyster Corporation, which make forklifts, and we got Keller Industry, which extrude aluminum and make aluminum windows and glass and lawn furniture. We got all those three in the same year, and I doubt and I think by industrial standards and development in the state of Kentucky, I don't think any city ever got three factories in 1 year.
In 1 year.
And we also have Dresser Industries down here that makes all types of gauges, and we have the Parker Hannifin Corporation has Breer Rubber Company here, which is the premium O-ring, which they use in hydraulics, and they use in almost everything that's made. The premium O-rings in the United States are made right here in Berea.
That's been a big help to small farmers, hasn't it?
It's been a big help. So what we've got here at Berea, we've got a blend of agriculture and industry. And then the biggest employee, or the largest employer in this area in our town is Berea College. I think they count their workforce something about like 1,100.
How many of those people are farmers?
Of the people at Berea College?
The people that work inside Berea City Limits.
Oh, the people that do the service jobs, that work in the service stations, and the people that handle the sanitation department and work for the sewer department, you know, and the city park. I'd say I couldn't give you an exact figure, but I'm going to guess that 80% of them come from out in that Rockcastle rural area, and some of them could come out around Kirksville in the Madison area, but the man raised on a farm don't mind hard work, and those jobs are hard work jobs, and therefore they're smart enough to hire people that's been used to hard work, and most of the city people don't want to work like, you know, like a man that lives on Clear Creek with, I could think of some names, which I wouldn't want to mention the name, but he's tickled death with riding a garbage truck.
Mm-hmm.
But it's called a sanitation department, and he's tickled death. He lives in my house, and he works at Berea 5 days a week for the city, and then he lives in this house over there for little or nothing, and he has a garden, and he kills a hog, and he lives on a farm. He doesn't. He owned one when he sold it, and he put that money in the bank, and he's drawing interest on his money. And I think the fella probably has a fourth or a fifth or sixth grade education.
And he's got the best of.
I think he does. I think it's.
He has a job.
I put it this way, it really suits him.
Yeah.
It really suits
him. They all
want
to live on that farm.
And then we've got, I can think of my neighbor, two of my neighbors go to Lexington every day and put hang drywall, two of the best in the state. And they're off of Clear Creek, and they get paid by the square foot for doing work, and they make good money, and they have their little farm, and then they make $2,000 or $3,000 or $4,000 off of their little farm, plus they make I'm going to guess $15,000 or $20,000 a year of hanging drywall. Hired King is another fellow over there, and then there's a lot of prominent people that's come off of that little valley. That little valley is approximately I'm going to guess it to be 14 or 15 miles long, with three or four little tributary hollers or valleys that come off from it. And I can think of one man that's prominent. He's retired now, Jack T.J. Woods. He was vice president of Procter & Gamble, and he's the retired chairman of the board of trustees of Berea College. He's a multimillionaire. He came off of Clear Creek and worked his way through college. And then another fella, the other fella been prominent out of that area that lived on the upper end, is Ronald Swinford, was executive vice president of New York Life Insurance, which, you know, I would say corporation-wise, that's two of the biggest corporations in the United States, and the second man come off of that valley. And I'm sure that there's lots of other prominent people, like I know some farmers are, like Doc Wolf and another farmer or two there that's directors in the Mount Vernon Bank and own it, that come off that creek. A fellow by the name of Wolf came off of there that owned about half that valley, and he owned stock in three banks. He owned stock in the Broadhead Bank and controlling interest in the Mount Vernon Bank and the second largest stockholder of the, which these were older people. So Clear Creek's furnished the labor force in Rockcastle County from that section and come to Madison County and furnished the labor force for us, and also furnished a lot of top executives for rich companies. And I think that that might be what it's all about, is somebody coming from a rural area that's not maybe be educated in a, and well, those people were educated in one-room schoolhouses and worked their way through Berea College. So,
well, let me ask you one more question, and we'll end it up. Don't you think children that grow up on a farm, they do farm work, they grow up with responsibility, you think those people turn out to be better citizens as a whole?
Well, you know, I don't have a degree in the environment. I think, my personal opinion, I think two things. I think you inherit through heredity. I think you inherit these genes and intelligence that you have to have, and then I think that probably makes up in your family life probably makes up for probably 60 or 65%. And I think that farm life might add that other 35 or 40. I don't think you have to live on a farm to be a good person, but I think at any time you work the land and you see nature work, then I think in turn there ought to be a certain amount of tranquility to you that should settle, you know. I mean, you know where a potato comes from and where it grows above the ground or below the ground.
You learn responsibility, don't you?
And you, if you're raised on a farm like that, you're going to, I know my upbringing, I haven't been in all the houses, but the people that I grew up with at farm, I knew that every kid had a job, you know, and you had to perform your job just like, it's not, I don't think I'm probably the good example. I think I spoiled my kids, and my kids were raised in town, and they don't have a responsibility, and I probably did wrong by that. I don't think I could have raised two better kids, because I've got a son that's a senior at Eastern, and I've got a girl that never made nothing but an A, and she's a cheerleader. But at the same time, I think that she might have missed something because we didn't live out on the farm. Mm-hmm. And I don't think you have to be raised on a farm to be a good person, but I think it might help.
But you need that background, and they do realize.
I think it would help. Yeah. I think that you might.
I think so.
I think any time that you live on a farm, and you have to have responsibilities, and I don't think it hurts you to learn to work. And I know some of the better people I've seen came from large families off the farms.
Yeah.
I don't mean that all the good people did, because there's good people.
But your chances seem like are better with that farm background.
Well, I think it would be preferred by most people my age, looking mm-hmm. back.
I think it will be everyone looking back when it's all said and done. Mr. Fraley, I sure do thank you. I didn't mean to take all of your day, and I would like to come back sometime and talk to you about whaling.
Well, I would be glad to talk with you, and I appreciate you giving me a chance to express myself, and I just hope that if anybody listens to this tape or anything, that I hope that I said something that might
I'm sure it'll be
beneficial, and I hope I didn't paint any picture that wasn't true.
Oh, I don't think so. I think it's pretty well what I've heard all along. Well, thanks again.
You're welcome.